Welcome to This Week on Channel 9. I'm Dan Fernandez.
I'm Ed Keim.
And this week is kind of our live mesh week. It's kind of our live mesh episode. So
yeah, mesh is the big news this week, and I think we got a lot of cool content to cover it.
Yeah. So big news was we had Ray Ozzie. So this is, you know, kind of, I don't want to say pet project, but something Ray's been really thinking about, how Microsoft takes and
goes on and on about mesh at lunch every day.
Yeah, exactly. You know how he ties his shoes? He ties them like four squares, yeah. Just so there's like a mesh. Of, yeah.
I heard all his interview questions are mesh themed.
Oh, really?
I almost said they were meth themed. We're going to have to edit that out.
Yeah, of course. So what's interesting to me is, and this was John Udell, and they were actually in the studio. So they were in these chairs. You look at the positioning, I think he was in my chair. So,
yeah, the nine guy's not there. Well, he's on the camera. But.
Okay, so what was interesting from that interview, obviously, is Ray's done a ton of things that have helped influence mesh. So things like Lotus Notes and groupware and collaboration and ability to do Lotus Notes as online, offline. And then you look at Groove, and there's certainly a lot of similarities in some of the other projects, even at Microsoft, like Folder Share. And it kind of reminded me of whenever new technology launches, we as humans always do the association like, oh, that's just like so-and-so, but with X. And it's kind of like the Rorschach test with those huge ink blots where you look at something and you're like, that definitely looks like, you know...
It's a butterfly all the time.
That is a bear, and he is, you know, bloodied. So that's what I see. And I think it's because...
Butterfly.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So I think we should go to a clip and let Ray explain it and then give the folks at home a chance to figure out what they think after that first butterfly view, and then we'll tell them what they should think.
Exactly.
We basically said the OS as it is right now, the OS for the phone, the OS for the device, the Xbox, the OS for a Zune, the OS for the PC, are all designed more or less to expose the resources of that device to developers and to users, but they're really not designed in concert with other devices. What's going on in the web is mostly done serving the web and the browser. It's largely disconnected from those devices. If we were designing an operating environment for users or developers today, looking forward, it would probably look a little bit different. It would look like something that would bring those devices together for the end user. And so that's one thing that Live Mesh does. It brings together your devices. You kind of claim, you use the web as a hub to claim your device. You securely identify yourself as an authorized user of this device. Multiple people can own a device as authorized users, and multiple people can, and each person can have many devices. Once you've said that this is your device, it enables many, many things. It enables kind of centralized health monitoring and status reporting. It enables settings, kind of replication, across. Your devices and computers where you think appropriate. It lets data flow amongst those devices, whether files and folders or other things I'll talk about in a minute, like feeds. And it lets applications be configured, and potentially licensed and things like that across, your device mesh. And in solving the problem of getting things to work across your devices, the same kind of technologies can be used for multiple people. So if you have, share a folder of documents with, if you're working on a set of documents that are on your desktop with someone else, those same technologies that are used to synchronize that folder across devices can be used for me to share it with you or another set of people. So, from the user's perspective, we think that this Live Mesh thing can really transform your experience with multiple PCs and things like your phone to make the experience very seamless.
All right. It looks like Ray's pretty thorough. Now, what was your first view on it?
Yeah, so my first view was actually one kind of Folder Share and Groove. But then I started looking at some of the stuff, and in particular the developer things. I think one of the challenges is they have what's confusing is they have the Live Mesh architecture and they have the Live Mesh application. So the Live Mesh application is what a lot of people are looking at, but if you actually look at the architecture, which we'll get into in the dev stuff, it's pretty different. So we'll actually go ahead and, or actually give your thoughts. What's the first thing you thought of?
So from the outside, it was interesting for me because my first introduction to a lot of the mesh stuff that's gone on has been through the public announcement and the blog postings. And at first, I kind of just blew it off and I said, well, this is, you know, as you said, looking at the apps, it seems like it's a folder share replacement or a replacement for some of the other synchronization stuff that's available. But when you look deeper at it, you start to realize, you know, the distinction between the apps and the platform. And the platform brings a lot of the vision of WinFS out and makes it pretty cool for people to be able to program against this store that has better data types, first of all, because you're looking at files and higher level data. But also, when you start to remove the challenges that had to do with synchronization and backup and peer-to-peer communication and the things that occur there, that you're getting them really for free. You don't have to think about them.
Right.
These scenarios for existing apps and apps you might build in the future, things you would have just kind of like blown off in the past, that I'm not even going to bother going after that because there's too much infrastructure work. That's not a problem anymore. And I think that is going to help people a lot, especially with all the data. As more and more applications start to take advantage of this, you're going to see more sharing of data between these things. And I think that when we build software, we start to realize that when we get these things for free, we have to take advantage of them as soon as we can to get that edge on the market.
I don't know what you just said, but sure. next slide. This is Nick. So this is actually Nick showing the Live Mesh application in action, his hands-on. So let's take a look at the clip.
The laptop that we're using is actually my work laptop, so you can see here that it's already part of my mesh. I'm going to go ahead and minimize the browser, and one of the things that you'll see is these folders that look like the rest of my mesh. And those folders are synchronizing across my different computers.
That's a different icon. That's a blue icon.
Yeah. That's right.
We wanted
some way to make it really easy to identify folders that are either shared with other people through the mesh or synchronized with other computers through the mesh.
Okay, great.
So any of these blue icons are indicating these are folders that are part of your mesh and that are synchronized or shared.
Okay. Mesh folders.
Mesh folders. Yeah. All right, great. So let's have a look at how do I connect to another device that's actually part of my mesh. And then once I've connected, what can I do?
Great. So once I've added this computer to my mesh, I've downloaded the software, one of the things that you'll see is this notifier. The notifier is helping me get to the stuff in my mesh, including the news of what's been going on. Here's that list of devices that you were that we saw in the device ring.
Okay, there they are.
And then from here, I can really very quickly connect to any of those other devices as long as they're online. So if I go ahead and open this connection, this is my work computer in the building,
sure.
Not too far from here. So it's going to go ahead and open that connection.
And this is looking like a remote desktop interface, is that what it is?
That's exactly correct.
Under the covers, it uses the same live remote desktop technology that you've seen in Windows and other things. But it's able to go through firewalls, it's able to go through NATs. This really will work anywhere with any topology.
Okay, great. So we are now, this is now your work desktop.
That's right. This is now my work desktop. And if I go ahead and maximize this, it's like sitting right in front of my machine at work. And
sure.
It's great because there might be some applications on that machine that aren't on this particular laptop. So one of those applications, for example, could be Photoshop. And so here's an example of me being able to use that computer on my desktop at work to edit a Photoshop file, not only from my laptop when I'm away from it, but this same exact experience can be done directly through an internet browser. So if I was at your house and I didn't have a computer with me, but I wanted to do something on one of my computers, I could just go to mesh.com, see that device ring, and connect to one of my computers from there.
Okay, so some cool stuff there. Now I know the first scenario that this application is going to kill. It's the, have you ever emailed yourself, like, some attachment, some PowerPoint file?
Just to have it there.
Now, assuming this is technical preview, and it's a tiny technical preview, and it's U.S. only, but if you imagine, you know, a world 3 years, 5 years from now where mesh is everywhere, and you have your live desktop where you can get at files anywhere, you no longer need to email yourself that file. It's literally just in that live folder from your desktop, and then you can access it whether it's on the web, whether it's on another machine that's on the mesh or not.
Yeah, and when you talk about mesh being everywhere, really we're just saying that there's a little client piece that has to be installed that knows how to communicate with the mesh, and then all the software that would use the mesh would just integrate with that client piece directly. So there's no real major concern about there being global availability. It's just more about getting those on the end user machines. So
yeah, so Jeremy was talking about some of the issues, because they do encryption when you're actually sending files, because, you know, it's your personal files. Mm-hmm. So they have a lot of regulatory stuff to figure out to get that to work in the EU or whatever. But, you know, if I'm emailing myself a file because I know I'm only going to have, like, RAS access or web access, or I need to print something at Kinko's, all I need to do is put it from my desktop into the live mesh, and then from Kinko's I can just log on to that mesh and download that file. So I actually don't need anything installed at Kinko's to access mm-hmm. that file.
Yeah, it's some pretty cool stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And there's, of course, support coming.
And then you've got the application platform opportunity for people that want to build software.
So here's the interesting
the
stuff.
The code is the best.
Yes.
When you actually look at what it takes to get started with grabbing something, for example, creating a mesh object, and then being able to work with data from there. And the nice thing is that it's really seamless. There's a lot of different ways to get at the code, but we can see here from some managed code in C# that it's a couple lines of code to get started, and there's virtually no config. I mean, it's very simple.
Exactly, and you can use Link, which is also a nice
Link.
Item. And some of the examples we'll look at later, you can use Iron Python, and really, I guess it's a couple slides later, we can go into one of the other ones. We'll actually show you can use anything, because these are just RSS feeds.
Yep.
So here's like the high-level way they handle resources. So in the application, live mesh application they have, you might have a mesh object, which may be like a file or a set of files or a file folder. And those will all have different information, and they'll have different ways to access them as well, which you'll look at later in the chart. And then this thing, which is news, which is kudos to like Facebook for getting everybody to do like an activity feed for everything. But this has an activity feed, so you know, so-and-so updated this file, so-and-so has copied this file over, so-and-so has done this. That's all sort of like the end user's news feed and all these different applications. And the user's in control, so I guess similar to Facebook is you have to give that application permission to look at files in your mesh, and obviously you want to do the right security things there and have the user control what exactly that application can see and not see.
Yeah, and turning to the developer stack side of things,
yes.
Because of the fact that you're dealing with RSS feeds and JSON and just really all these industry standards,
yes.
You start to get great tool support, because all the tools out there already exist to work with these. And as a result, it's free. I mean, you use Visual Studio or you use Eclipse or Xcode or
It's an open platform.
Yeah, very open. And that's going to be incredibly beneficial to people building on not just Windows, but on, for example, Mac or, you know, maybe Series 60 devices. There's just a lot of opportunity out there for all developers everywhere. And once these pieces come together, we're going to see some really broadly reaching software.
And for web applications, like, say, so I'm incredibly low on the totem pole, but we were talking theoretically about some of the applications you can build using this stack, and you have no authority or information inside Microsoft at all.
Not really.
Yeah, we just found you around the hallway next to a bloody shoe.
Where's Keller this week?
Yeah, Keller's in Florida. He left us another bloody shoe. I don't know what's wrong with him. But you think about some of the applications that you can build. Like, you can build some pretty powerful stuff. If I'm, say, Facebook, and I want to be able to send activity feeds to Mesh, I just need that user to install Facebook application, then they can actually write into, say, my Mesh, and I can find out information going on within there, and it's all just a RESTian exchange of information. So, pretty interesting stuff that you can do online and offline, and some of the things that weren't covered in the videos, some of the scenarios. So what are the ideas that you would have that you would build with this stack?
Well, I think the first thing I would do is just take what I build today and try to make some of these situations better. One example is, let's just take mail. I mean, I use Outlook for mail 90% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
I have two different machines that are primarily used and a couple other machines that I'll use when I'm either on-site at Microsoft or other places. I would love it if, instead of having to keep an OST at all these different places that's like gigs, if it would just be able to synchronize the data up to a store. So not only do I not have to worry about pulling that data down every time I go somewhere, but it would automatically sync just the diffs between the machines.
Because you're storing something to your local file, and then it's not on that other machine.
And I do want it local, and that's another key thing about Mesh, is that you get local caches of the data. So the data is on your machine as you pull it down and you work with it. So when you go offline, you still have access to data. And then I haven't really dug into the synchronization story for after the fact, but the point is, this isn't an online-only thing. And that is something that I think might get lost in some of the PR and the other talks about this. But you could take stuff offline, and that's really critical, I think, for business or personal applications.
Yeah, so speaking of offline, I think one of the other interesting things, and this almost becomes similar to Google Gears, where you can take an application and make that offline. So one of the examples we'll look at later with Ori is he has a Silverlight application, and he makes that application available offline. So when that application is offline, it's using the local store, but when it's actually online, it goes ahead and syncs with the mesh. So you could, like, rather than me, you know, even Jeff Sandquist was doing this with the current version of Mesh, where he has, like, the USB applications that you can just install on a thumb drive, like FileZilla and a couple others for FTP and things. He has them on his Mesh, so he never needs to reinstall applications. He just double-clicks the EXE from the Mesh, and that application is working there. So really handy for, and you think about if they can evolve this as a way to distribute Windows applications, where your Windows application settings, rather than me needing to worry about my IE8 homepage, my IE8 store, my IE8 favorites, all that stuff could be in the mesh, and I don't even need to install the application because there's nothing, say, local. I just double-click the application. So a way to actually share Windows applications. The other thing is the messaging pipeline, where you could actually do something like a messenger application by having a messenger, by using some of the feed pipelines and just sending messages one between the other. So I think there's a whole different kind of a set of classes of applications that could be built. So a lot of stuff.
Yeah. So we have a video as well.
Yeah. So Charles caught up with Abelaide. And Abelaide walks through some of the architecture on what actually happens on the server side when there's, like, say, a request to synchronize. So let's take a look at the clip.
Well, what we've done is that we have two kinds of storage in the synchronized storage service. So we have metadata. So this includes information, you know, about the feeds, you know, about the entries. It also includes information that supports the sharing, that supports the sharing capability. So if I add you as a member, you know, of a particular mesh object, so that you can synchronize the feeds as well and map them to your devices, that information is stored in the metadata store.
Okay.
Now, in addition, we also have information about blobs. So when I pull you know, a feed into the storage service, you know, I want the contents that's associated with those with entries in those feeds to be available. In the case of a file system folder, those contents would be the actual files, right? And then the third kind of information is actually transient information as well. So analogously to how the accounts to the how the Live Mesh Directory service maintains transient state. To support device connectivity, the synchronized storage service support maintains transient state. You know, to help you, you know, with things like, you know, you navigate into a folder. It's useful for me to be able to see, you know, which other users are interacting with this particular, you know, Live Mesh folder that I'm interacting with, and that information is maintained in the context of an activity subservice inside the synchronized storage service.
So that's a good clip. Some interesting stuff that's getting shown there. One other clip we have, I'll set up real quick, is with Ori Amiga. And I had the honor of working with Ori on a few different occasions back in the
you
day.
Did like his dry cleaning?
Well, I wish I was up that high. But back when I was doing mobile stuff, when I was mobile developer product management, he was on the Windows Mobile team, and the stuff that, you know, he worked to with the teams there, I worked closely with him on helping out as I could. But, you know, he was driving some cool stuff, and we see where the Windows Mobile platform has gone today. And then he went over to the Visual Studio team for a while, and I know there was some really cool stuff, especially around the extensibility and getting the community back on track in terms of, like, some of the cool partner things that came out over the last couple of years. And now over in Windows Live, I mean, it gives me a lot of confidence personally to see him there, because he's a guy who everything he seems to touch turns to gold here. And I think this this demo is a good example of some of the cool flash that he can bring to the game. So I'm going to let him take over.
Yeah, so let's watch the clip.
We're going to take a web application and bring it into the mesh. So this app, some of you might have seen the Photo Zoom application we pushed out not too long ago by Matt Augustine. Very, very cool app. It incorporates Silverlight, Deep Zoom. Nice. So this app lets you do this. Is, of course, a web application, Silverlight application. Actually, we can go take a look at where I live. So we're going to zoom into this photo really deeply. Look at that detail you get on the Space Needle.
You live on the Space Needle?
Well, I live right next to the Space Needle. This application is running currently online. Now, what if you wanted to be a little extreme and say, you know, what if I can run this application everywhere in my mesh, including offline? The mesh application model, one of the types of applications we support is this kind of app. And if I go back to my mesh, look at the applications that are currently provisioned in my mesh, you'll notice that PhotoZoom, that app, is one of the apps that's provisioned in my mesh. And what that enables me to do is actually we're going to go to my desktop, and we're going to launch the PhotoZoom app right inside this container. Now, let's talk for a second about what happened here. Mm-hmm. This is the exact same HTML and exact same Silverlight code, identical to what's running in my other application. You didn't rewrite it. You packaged it in a way. You essentially give us a manifest that the mesh app model understands. Mm-hmm. You described your application. You said, hey, run this in my mesh. What we could do is actually we can take that code and the data, synchronize it to the client, and run it offline. So now if I pull the network cable, this application will continue to run with its data. So I can come in here.
You should make the point about where those pictures are coming from.
So these pictures, when you described your application, these pictures, the data you described and you essentially hinted to us, put this in the mesh data model, in the mesh resource model. Mm. We take the pictures, the metadata, and the physical data itself. We synchronize it using our sync engine for offline. Now, it's not just about photos, because let's put a comment about this photos. Wow. Space. How about just space rocks?
Yeah.
Huh. I'm going to hit post. So we're going to post a comment about this photo. This is running in a host on my local machine. Now, if I go back to the web app, I go back to the web application we were looking at and hit F5, check
there
this out. It actually went, what happened, that client application, when I posted that comment, was mm-hmm. posting it locally. It went to local Mo and said, let's make a comment. Mm-hmm. The sync engine picks that up, synchronizes it through the mesh, and if I go to this online sort of site, and I'd say, man, this is neat, and we're going to post another comment. Now I'm posting this on a website app running in the cloud somewhere, nothing to do with the mesh, on a third-party app server, think of it like that.
Mm-hmm.
We'll take that data, and again, bring it back into the mesh,
nice.
And check this out. There's the comment we just made on the website. And there's no direct connectivity between that app and this app. This guy puts it into the mesh in the data model, gets synchronized with the sync engine, picks up, there's events that get fired, this guy picks it up over here. And so these applications, these web apps, can essentially now run offline, work with offline data, and get that synchronized back to our cloud and then back to a third-party developer site.
So, yeah, some really cool stuff there. And
there's a lot to dig into with Live Mesh. So, and it's really just, you know, we're at the technical preview stage, so there's so much stuff that can go on. Like, the only other aspect that I could imagine, or that like I'm just intrigued by, is products like, what about Windows Home Server? Like, you could imagine having, and again, we were very low on the totem pole and I just found you, but Windows Home Server, you could imagine that being like a mesh server. And you could have your own personal mesh. So, like, let's say you didn't want to have some stuff on the clouds. You just wanted to have, you know, you illegally download movies from BitTorrent, so they should arrest you right now. Let's just say.
Yes.
Right. Theoretically.
I don't, but if I did.
You could have your own custom mesh, say, in Windows Home Server. That way you could access your files, and you would be accessing that in the same way a Windows Home Server. And you could then even have mesh-to-mesh synchronization. So user-to-user applications, user to service, and then say something like Groove in the enterprise, where you could have, or even something like SharePoint using mesh, where you could have an enterprise version where a company doesn't want to have all their stuff on the mesh. they could have their own version of mesh, and how all these different meshes connect is kind of percolating, if you will, for lack of a better word. But there's other stuff going on as well.
You know, it turns out that there was another company that made an announcement this week on the internet, of all places, as though there was still room.
Yes,
and
I know.
It's pretty exciting to talk about PhotoBucket, who has an API for developers to access their contents now and to do a lot more.
Yeah, I think PhotoBucket, and this is via Alvin Ashcraft, but PhotoBucket's like number three in the world in terms of number of photos. So the nice thing is they now have a developer API. You have to sign up to get a key, but then you can do the classic things you would do with a photo service like Flickr. Frankly, this is kind of like long overdue, but I'm just really happy, and the APIs are really easy too. So it's RESTian APIs.
And there's something to be said for not being the first. I mean, you know, they talk about people who are the pioneers in a space, and you know, there is an old saying in the world of business that you can tell who the pioneers are because they're the ones with the arrows in their backs. There's always people behind you. There's always people behind you coming, and they're going to see where you make mistakes, and they're not going to make the same mistakes. And I think the PhotoBucket API is an example of an API that's already mature in V1. And a lot of the stuff that's going to be available to people as it moves is great because they've been able to kind of see where people have gone and take advantage of that. So there's really cool stuff coming. And this stuff, I believe it's already out there, too. I mean, it's not even coming. It's there. But I think the apps that are going to come as a result of this are going to be big.
Yeah. And frankly, even when I look at the photo bucket, like, there's so many examples where, like, I have photos in different places where I just want to be able to have them all either crosswire or share across each other. So I'm thinking mesh.
Yes, we did mesh.
Yeah. I can't stop.
But we will give you a chance, I think, for pick of a week. What do you think of that?
Yes, pick of the week. So I'm a big fan of Jeff Atwood's Coding Horror blog. He does some great stuff. If you're looking to build a machine, he did a multi-part series. That's actually how my wife built her game box, using some of his tips. But this was interesting in that it was everything I need to know about programming I learned from BASIC. And don't say a word. Now, how did you learn to program?
Well, the first one, of course, I think a lot of people, they forget about it, but Logo was my first experience.
Oh, yeah.
You know, pen up, pen down.
The turtle.
The turtle. He just walked around.
Fear the turtle.
But my first more formal, not even formal, but after that, I guess it was about 1994 or so, I was given the option at a yard sale of buying an Apple IIe or a Commodore 64.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't think the Apple would actually run. Because of the condition it was in. It wasn't taken care of well. It was very clear. And so I went for the Commodore, which came with a book. And it was just like an owner's manual. But it turns out about the back third of the book or so was BASIC. It was just a BASIC language introduction. And so I used BASIC for a while, and I made some games. And back then, you know, you didn't really have a drive. You just, if you had a floppy, you put that in, and you would be able to load from there and run your games.
Yeah.
And then that was basically it. I haven't programmed.
And then it went
since.
Downhill.
That was it. I've been using BASIC for, I guess that's about it. And we're looking at programming off the 64 one of these days. But I have a theory that technology is cyclical.
Oh, really? You think it's going to come back?
I think
back,
there's a new Altair coming out any day now. And then that will lead way to a whole new generation of green screen Commodore 64 apps. So stay tuned.
Yeah.
I think
What was funny about this was Jeff actually bought this. It was a programming kit for the Atari 2600 that had paddles to do programming. So it was like you press a number 4, then you press like a symbol, like plus, and then 4. He has pictures of the paddle in the blog post. It's absolutely hilarious.
Well, when I got started, I didn't even have a paddle and a turn. No, I remember the first program I had to write completely in hex using an ATM keypad.
Oh, shut up.
Yeah, and the 8 was broken. So I just had to tap the 4 twice really fast in order to get those in. And if I needed any instructions that were higher than 9, I was basically SOL, so.
Yeah, no, that's right. So I learned to program using BASIC, and in fact, one of the books that Jeff Atwood pulled out was like this basic computer game program, and it was how I learned to program. So there's always been sort of like this soft spot for Apple IIe was my machine, and programming some BASIC games. And when I got some other BASIC games, looking at the source and then modifying them so I could win the poker game. So it was
nice.
It was kind of funny. to do that trial and error. And it was a simpler time. Things were so easy.
You should do a show with just some of the folks at Microsoft about their first experiences, like where they got started with programming and, you know, because there's some folks that started back in, like, the Stone Age. I mean, they were working. No, seriously, I mean, I think there's a guy I met once over on the .NET team whose first programming was just, like, banging two
punch
copper
cards.
Wires together and making sparks, and, you know, it was one and zero, and somehow he evolved that into Word, I think. But
yeah, I think that code's still in there.
It could be.
Now, you had a pick of the week.
I did, and of course, mine involves robots. Microsoft. Well, so Microsoft is kicking off RoboChamps.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is pretty exciting. Anybody in the robotics space or have any interest at all? I love the robotics stuff personally. It's just interesting to me. Like, we were involved with Maker Faire next week,
which we're going to be.
We should
next
plug
week.
Maker Faire.
Yes.
A bunch of folks from my team will be down there, and I know you and a bunch of the Microsoft folks will be down and get to show off different things. Like, you know, anytime you get to build something that sort of has a life of its own, the way robotics can start to evolve in that way is always fun. And being able to see these pieces work, some of them are very elaborate machines that do very little, but at the same time, it's fun. It's
yes.
fun to be able to get that process done. Like, you know, half the time we're building something in robotics, we have to break a perfectly working thing in order to make it work with something else not as well.
And that's the spirit of Make. That's why I personally love Maker Faire. So.
And I think, so you look at that, Maker Faire, of course, RoboChamps. There's a RoboCup, I think, is going on right now. And there's
so just for people that maybe not familiar with RoboChamps, we'll show a clip in a second, but it's a virtual, you download the robotics studio that has a virtual simulator and some built-in simulated world to, like, Seattle, like some other place, and the surface of Mars.
Yeah.
And then the goal is, like, you code or program or macro record, if you will, this robot going through this world and then see if it makes it as they change the world. And then you compete against other people on RoboChamps to be the coolest robot. So, but let's take a look at a clip.
So I'm going to click the drive button here, and you can see that we're using the Xbox 360. Okay. I'm just going to click this here, and we're in action.
All right.
So we can go ahead and explore the environment.
And as you're exploring, if this were actual competition, are you, like, fighting against another robot? Is it one-on-one, team, capture the flag? What kind of competition
is it? So it's a great question. So these are less about battle, but it's all about competition.
Okay.
Right. So you're not going to be bludgeoning anyone in these games. But a lot of times it's you versus the environment, so you start off with that maze.
I see.
Then you're the Mars rover, so you're going to be driving this thing around on Mars and doing some exploration there. There's a city environment where you're driving downtown, but there's other cars around. So in theory, you could take it and start smashing other cars if you wanted to. I mean, and that's one of the cool things about it. It is sort of like an open world scenario where you can go and do some other interesting things. So we've got a city. It's designed for these tasks, right, that you'll go off and do. But there's, like, outdoor French cafes and grocery stores and parking lots. So you could start doing some interesting stuff on your own.
So as you can see, RoboChamps is some cool stuff, and that's why it was my pick of the week.
Very nice. Okay. So that's all we got, and I'm sure we'll have more stuff next week when we are in Maker Faire. So cool stuff.
Very cool.
Thanks, Ed.
See you next week.